So, our first speaker today is John Bibby. John is policy officer at Shelter, and he's going to give a bit of a an overview of what we're talking about here today. Come up, John. You can use that. It's up to okay. You. High tech.
Okay. Thanks for asking me to give a bit of an overview on rent stabilisation. Before I get on to rent stabilisation, I want to spend a bit of time talking about the problem as it's been set up. And the problem as it's been set up is the affordability of renting in London and the problem of the unaffordability of renting in London. And I want to try and say something a little bit about how serious that problem is at the moment. And this is an attempt to illustrate this. So 35% of your income after tax and benefits is typically considered to be the limit and the extent of what is affordable to pay on your housing costs. Any more than that, you begin to eat into the amount of money that you would need to spend on food or utilities, clothing, other household bills. Now, of course, that's not a perfect measure. No single measure is ever going to be perfect because every household's needs are different, but it's the best measure that we have. This is an attempt to suggest how we're doing in London, and it's a comparison between the median full-time earner's pay by borough and the median rent for a one-bed flat by borough. And 35% is the yellow, so only one borough really gets that 35%, which is Bexley, and I know we've got somebody here from Bexley, so well done, Bexley. 35% is the yellow, and the black is where you're paying. If you were a median renter trying to access that median one-bed flat, you would be paying over 50% in your take-home pay in rent. Now, of course, this is just an illustration, and it's not perfect, because it doesn't take into account that in some boroughs you would be receiving housing benefit. It doesn't take into account the fact that if you were a median earner, you might not be trying to access that median rented home. But it also doesn't take into account the fact that typically renters don't earn as much as the average. This is just an attempt to illustrate how serious the problem is, but we do know that the problem of rental affordability has serious consequences. And at Shelter, we've done quite a lot of research on what those consequences are, and it's led to households making some quite difficult decisions about how they're going to be able to pay their rent. It means that households in rented accommodation are getting deeper into debt. They're going further into arrears on other household bills. It means they're cutting back on spending on leisure. They're taking fewer holidays, which you might not think is a particularly serious thing, but it does obviously impact upon your quality of life. It means that they're spending less on food, and in some instances it means that their parents are skipping meals in order to be able to pay the rent. Of course, lack of affordable properties also means that there is less opportunity for mobility because there's fewer places for new entrants into the market to go into. And the consequences of this lack of affordability also has serious impact upon the housing benefit bill, which is particularly important at this time when the government has just committed to making £12 billion of welfare cuts and really doesn't have that many other places to go to once you count out the places that they've already said are protected. And finally, it has serious consequences for homelessness. Now, the loss of an assured short-hold tenancy is now the leading cause of homelessness in this country, and while we can't say that in every instance that's because the individual couldn't afford that AST, we can say that if there were more affordable private rented properties, then those individuals would probably have another option than becoming homeless. They would probably be able to access another private rented home. So what do we do about it? Well, why can't we just say, let's cap the amount that you can charge for a private rented property to the amount that the median full-time earner could afford? Why don't we do that? Why don't we just say that you can't charge any more than 35% of the median full-time worker's take-home pay in rent, and if you do, then we'll ban you from doing that. Well, this is what that would look like across London. So this is basically saying how much higher median rents are across London at the moment than what that sort of hypothetical cap would be. And you'll see that in three places, in Kensington and Chelsea, Westminster and the City of London, then rents are currently twice as much as that sort of hypothetical cap would be. And that out in East London, then you get the four boroughs who are kind of vaguely in the right, they wouldn't really be that affected. Now you might think that sounds like a bit of a silly question, why don't we do this? There's actually a proposal that currently exists This is from the 38 degrees petition, which suggests that we should cap rents for a one-bed home to £120 a week across London. And as you'll see, in terms of the impact that that would have across London, it's more serious than my proposed cap of the median rent. But this is something we should take seriously, and we should take it seriously for a couple of reasons. One, this petition has almost 70,000 signatures, and of course 100,000 signatures is the amount that you need for something to be discussed on the floor of the House of Commons. It also means that roughly 2-3% of London renters have signed up to this petition. So why can't we do it? Well, Nigel's going to come on to some of the reasons that we can't do it, but obviously this would have serious consequences. It would mean a major disinvestment from the private rented sector, which would lead to lots of landlords selling up, moving out, if you didn't try and stop them from doing that. And if you did try and stop them from doing that, it means that they would disinvest in another way. I mean, people who signed that petition would also say that it would mean that regulated rents were at an affordable level, but the consequences broadly, we can say, are more negative than would justify actually doing it. The thing I want to say to you right now, and if you take one thing away from what I say, is that there are other options for regulating rents than just putting in a pretty blunt and brute cap on rents across London. There are, in fact, quite a number of different options, and this is where we come onto something that Christine did a couple of years ago with her colleagues from Cambridge Centre for Housing and Planning Research. They put together a nice sort of list of the things that you might see in rent regulatory regimes, and the things that you can, the little levers that you can pull to try and affect what rents are doing. And the first one of those is obviously how much you're able to charge when somebody initially enters a tenancy, how much you're able to increase the rent over the course of that tenancy, the length of the lease, because obviously if your landlord can just kick you out and then jack up the rents, then that's not really going to affect rents overall, and then other things which affect the landlord's capacity to take back the property and sell it into owner occupation, for example. So there are lots of different options for how you could regulate rents. And of course, we know that there is more than just the brute option of sort of saying, well, this is the maximum ceiling on rents, because in England, we've had two other more serious rent regulatory regimes in the last 100 years than we have at the moment, and these broadly fit into two, although they're not exactly into two, but broadly fit into two, and that's from 1919 up to the late 60s, the rent freeze that is initially instituted at the beginning of the First World War in response to rapacious and exploitative rent increases that some landlords were reported to have made at the time. And then that was sort of watered down a bit as we came up to World War II, but then beefed up again in World War II, and that was also combined with some limits upon interest rates as well. And then after that, the fair rent regime that we had up until the 1988 Housing Act. The thing I want to say about both of those and the first proposal is that you can broadly say that they're something like rent caps or hard rent control. None of these are rent stabilisation, or what has in sort of recent years been dubbed rent stabilisation. And my view is that there's a lot about semantics here. Rent stabilisation is an attempt to detoxify something, in my view. But you wouldn't call any of these things rent stabilisation. So what is rent stabilisation? Well, broadly, it has two, possibly three principles. The first is that there is some limit on rent increases within the tenancy, that there is some more solid security of tenure. The final one is the option of some limit on the amount that you can increase the rent between tenancies, and that's not necessary, but it is something that some have. Just to say how these compare with the situation that we have at the moment. At the moment, while you do have some legal restrictions on rent increases, in practice they add up to very little, if not nothing. At the moment, in terms of security of tenure, you have a 6-month minimum period of an assured short-hold tenancy at the beginning, outside the fixed period that you agree in contract, which is typically 6 months, a year, 18 months, maybe even up to 2 years, then there is no security of tenure whatsoever. When you're in that statutory periodic rolling contract, then your landlord can say at any time and for any reason or no reason at all that you need to get out in the next 2 months. And finally, of course, there's no limit on the amount that rents can go up between tenancies. Now, In terms of what I think falls into rent stabilisation at the moment, then these are the four things that I've seen that sort of look different, or probably more, and they differ in some details, but broadly you could say they fit within that definition. And in terms of the details that they differ in, it's typically around how secure is that how secure is that tenancy. So I know we've got Daniel from Civitas in the room. Civitas' proposal is that you would have an indefinite tenancy length. Shelter is saying 5 years. The Labour Party's current proposal is for 3 years. And David Lammy's was for 3 years as well. He did come out with something slightly different. In terms of the amount that you could increase rents between tenancies, I think David Lammy's the only one there who's saying that you have any limit on between tenancies. There is a limit on the amount you could put it up, although it is incredibly lax limit. I mean, I can't imagine anybody increasing the rent 20% above market rates. So what does that do about the problem of affordability? Oops. The blunt fact is that the day after introduction, there is no change in terms of affordability. There is no forced rent cut, if we go back to that 38 degrees petition. There is no maximum chargeable rent that you can have. Bluntly, if you couldn't afford to pay your rent the day before rent stabilisation came in, you can't afford to pay it the day after rent stabilisation comes in. There is greater certainty about what your rent is going to do in the future, and you do have the capacity to plan and budget for change, but bluntly, there is no change for people who are in, who are already in. Does it stop it getting worse then? Well, that depends very much upon the details and the specifics. If we come back to those differences between the Civitas proposal and the Labour proposal, if you have a sort of more a longer term tenancy and you are in that tenancy when rent stabilisation is introduced, then there is the chance that over time your rent might be protected from going up. At the moment, you'll see CPI is currently at 0%. If you imagine that your rent is limited to the, you can only increase rents as much as inflation, then that 0% increase, if you have a lifetime long tenancy, is locked in for as long as you're there. So the fact that your rent wasn't increased this year is locked in for as long as you're there. If you're only there for 3 years, it's locked in for 3 years, and then you have to go back to the market and you receive a market rent. So quite how durable that that protection is, and quite how much the rent stabilisation prevents the rental affordability from getting worse over time, depends very much upon the specifics of what the limit on rent increases is and what the security of tenure you get is. So if it doesn't sort out affordability today, and it doesn't necessarily make it better over the long term, and it certainly doesn't make it better for new entrants over the long term, why bother? Why would you even bother? Why are we even talking about rent stabilisation? Well, my view is that that comes to the other problem, and the other problem is security of tenure. And the graph on the left here is one that I look at often, and it's one that shocks me every time I look at it. If you look at this, it says, and it might be quite difficult to see, but the red line here for private renters, this is the number of the proportion of private renters who've been in their home for less than 2 years, and it's 60% of private renters who've been in their home for less than 2 years. This is the proportion of private renters who've been in their home for more than 10 years, and it's 10%. Now, if you compare that to owner-occupiers, it was roughly flipped around. 10% of owner-occupiers have been in their home for less than 2 years, and 60% have been in for private renters have been in for more than 10 years. Now, you might say, why do we care about that? Why, you know, private renters, they love the flexibility. They love the opportunity to be able to move around often. Who doesn't like moving house? Well, I would say to you that Shelter knows that's not the case. We survey tenants regularly. We have a large sample size, and we find that 80% of private renters, when they're looking for a new home, think that it is either very important or fairly important that they're going to be able to stay there for the long term, which we classify as 5 years. So 80% of them want to be able to stay somewhere 5 years, 60% of them have been in their current home for less than 2 years. Now you might say, well, this is only a minor problem, it doesn't affect that many people. Private renting isn't even a mainstream tenure. Well, of course, I mean, you'd be wrong. Private renting is becoming a seriously mainstream tenure. The red line at the bottom there is the number of households who are living in private renting over time, and you'll see that it's increase significantly over time as the number of people who are buying with a mortgage has absolutely collapsed. And the thing that's more worrying about that is that 1.5 million households are now living with dependent children in the private rental sector. And if you can think about the impact that having to move every 1 or 2 years has upon a child within the private rental sector, then that is profound. The, even more worrying than that, the proportion of family households with dependent children in the private rental sector is also increasing. So it's growing in absolute numbers and as a proportion. So the reason that we should do something about this is not because of the rent increases and rental affordability. We know that it doesn't do that much about rental affordability, but we know that it does do something about security of tenure, and we know that you need that protection in terms of rent increases to do something about security of tenure, because otherwise your landlord can just kick you out by hiking the rent up. So, very quickly, to recap, London does have a genuine problem with high rents. But regulating for, with a brute cap or something like that is incredibly problematic and could lead to serious negative consequences. There are ways to stabilise rents and make them more predictable that hopefully won't have such serious consequences or won't have such serious consequences. They do have less of an impact upon affordability, so we need to look elsewhere to do something about affordability, and we can come on to that when we talk later on. But they do have other benefits, and we should not underestimate those other benefits.
Thanks, John. Thank you.